You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I am your co-host from BleacherReport.com, Chad Dundas, and joining me as always from MMA Junkie and USA Today, it's your friend and mine, Mr. Ben Folks. Ben, how you doing this week?
Doing fantastic.
Haven't had a hockey update in a while. Is the season over? You guys still trundling along?
This is the last week of hockey and win or lose until September. I don't know how I'm going to make it, to be honest with you.
You're going to have to find a new hobby.
I just don't see myself doing that. I see myself sitting at home in a darkened room, taping and retaping my stick over and over again, waiting for September to get here.
Curling.
You think that's a good summertime activity?
Hurling.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, hurling. That's an Irish sport.
Oh, okay, right. Where they hit each other in the head with sticks and stuff?
Yeah.
You know what? I'm gonna say that's a maybe for me right now.
Pretty sure we do have a hurling league or something.
I think actually you might be right. Yeah. I don't know how that would play with the pile of trash neck, to be honest with you.
High lie.
There we go. Now we're talking.
A little retro.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Probably it would fit right in with the times.
Yeah, sure. You could get myself some high lie shorts. I'm sure that must be a thing. Send away from them on the internet. Be in business.
Don't despair is what I'm saying. There's a lot of options out there.
I appreciate you thinking of me.
Even for a semi-crippled former Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner such as yourself.
Yeah, maybe. You know what? Maybe my summer hobby will just be coming over here and hanging out in your backyard. How about that?
Some work to do out there.
Don't see myself doing that.
I'll give you upwards of $5 an hour.
Drunk at 11 o'clock in the morning, just back here tearing grass out of the lawn with my bare hands. How about that?
I've been thinking about getting a neighborhood kid to come over and do it, but if I could get you, just the same. Probably just as drunk.
Yeah, won't even have to pay me. Just shut the curtains and pretend like I'm not out there.
Every once in a while, throw a black raspberry-flavored steel reserve out
right.
The back window.
Just puncture a hole in the can and roll it on out there like a grenade and let nature take its course.
New music alert, Ben. This one is interesting. This week's music comes to us from our colleague in the MMA media, Eric Fontanez.
What? He makes music?
Whose writing can currently be found over at BloodyElbow.com. And I got news for you, people. Eric Fontanez's hip-hop beats are real good.
Please tell me he also freestyle raps over them.
They are real good.
Oh, I can't wait for this.
We'll be featuring him on the podcast for the next several weeks, and if you like what you hear, you can find more from him at soundcloud.com/Eric Fontanez.
Okay, now I have to wonder, what are we going to have to do to get like a bunch of the writers from Bleacher Report to do like an a cappella music that we can play between rounds, like a barbershop quartet kind of thing?
I think we can handle that.
I mean, it feels like there's got to be a barbershop quartet with all the people you guys got to Bleacher Report. We just need to find them.
I've heard Jonathan Snowden has a beautiful tenor.
I believe it.
Don't be confused when you get to the SoundCloud page, though, because Eric Fontanez's stage name is Nameless, which he described to me in an email as, quote, just the word nameless spelled with one S, because you know how we hip-hop artists always have to misspell things.
I feel like we might want to workshop that, but we'll talk about it, Eric. We'll talk about it.
Thanks to him for the music. Really excited to get some Eric Fontanez joints on the air this week. Three rounds, as usual, also in the Co-Main Event Podcast in round number one. After nearly 6 years as one of the sport's most dominant champions, a 26-3 professional record, and a decade as one of the pound-for-pound most feared fighters in MMA, will Jose Aldo's legacy ultimately be defined by these two losses? Because that seems super shitty. And in round number two, legitimate question, how mad should we be, if at all, that Max Holloway will probably never get to fight Conor McGregor? And in round number three, hey, UFC, if you eventually have a falling out with every single person you ever do business with, how long before we can come around to the idea that maybe the real fucking goof is you? All that, plus, are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff? Sir Nigel Longstock is here. He's going to drop by, play a little Master Tweet Theater with us. Right now, though, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
The first piece of listener mail this week comes to us from Justice Latvala. He writes, gentlemen, What will be the legacy of Vitor Belfort whenever he decides to retire? A, a phenom with no known weaknesses and one of the greatest MMA fighters. B, the greatest cheater in MMA. C, annoying and arrogant Jesus lover. D, all of the above. E, none of the above. What say ye?
I feel like maybe some mix of all of that.
Yeah, it could be D, most of the above.
Yeah, in varying amounts, depending kind of on your perspective. I do think that it's going to be really difficult, if we're being honest with ourselves, looking back on Vitor Belfort's career more so than most people and not acknowledging the role that performance-enhancing drugs might have played. Just because the differences in that former Vitor and then the one that immediately followed the TRT era, just visually, are so impossible to ignore. And then you look at the record, and that also bears out that some changes took place.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, Vitor Belfort is one of these guys, well, for starters, has been in the game longer than almost anyone who remains an active fighter at this point, because you're talking about a guy who made his official MMA debut at Super Brawl 2 against John Hess on October 11th, 1996. So Vitor has been around for a while. You got to assume, as was the practice back there in 96, he probably had some like Luta Livre fights prior to that in Brazil or wherever before, you know, officially becoming a mixed martial arts fighter. And since then, he has been through some phases, I think you can say, to put it somewhat lightly. And like, I think that you're absolutely right. I think PEDs play a big part of the Vitor Belfort legacy. I think that he is going to kind of be, in a lot of different ways, the poster boy for a couple of different eras, perhaps, of not only fighting, but like performance enhancing drug use in the sport, because clearly he's the guy that we think of when we talk about testosterone replacement therapy, even though, you know, there were other high profile practitioners like Dan Henderson and guys that seem to kind of, escape a lot of the scrutiny that we give to Vitor Belfort. Obviously there's some, extenuating circumstances with Belfort. He's one of the guys that ostensibly kind of got caught in being over the limit TRT wise, and a guy that, had popped positive for PEDs in the past. And a guy like, if you just want to ballpark it and use the eye test, a guy who trundled through many different body types.
Well, yeah, and that's, I think that goes along with what you're saying, that he spanned so many different eras and there were so many different phases of Vitor Belfort's career, and not just physically, although he did arguably inhabit more different bodies than any other fighter, with, you know, the possible exception of like Alistair Overeem. There's just so many different Vitor Belforts. So if you look back and you ask yourself, you know, what's his legacy in MMA, it kind of can't help but be a bunch of stuff, because he's been around for so long and he's been so many different people throughout that era. Plus, if you believe him, it's not over yet. You got 5 more fights, Chad.
Yeah, he walked back the quasi-retirement talk, or at least the quasi maybe going to leave the UFC and join Bellator, which already has the senior circuit tour that he's been advocating for over in the Octagon. So yeah, as it always seems to be, Ben, weird times for Vitor Belfort, kind of teasing an exit from the Octagon leading up to his win over Nate Marquardt this weekend at UFC 212, and then kind of maybe left us with the idea that he's going to stick around for a while.
Well, I wonder, I mean, that decision could have conceivably gone the other way. Maybe if you don't do that one in Rio, maybe it goes a different way. I wonder if you lose that decision, if you still are going out and saying you got 5 more fights left in you, if you're Vitor Belfort.
Yeah, who knows? Probably not. Above and beyond performance-enhancing drug issues, though, Vitor Belfort fought in almost every conceivable era of the sport at this point.
Almost every conceivable promotion,
yep,
that matters.
Fought almost everywhere, fought almost everybody. Here's a guy that fought Tank Abbott, Ghetto Man, Joe Charles, Chuck Liddell, Randy Couture, Dan Henderson, Alistair Overeem, Tito Ortiz, Rich Franklin, Anderson Silva, John Jones, Chris Weidman.
Matt Lindland.
I'm just naming guys off the list. And then this weekend, obviously, Nate Marquardt. So kind of did everything that you could possibly do in this sport if you're Vitor Belfort, which, you know, is probably something to hang your hat on, at least personally.
Yeah. Let's say you could have your choice here. Vitor Belfort re-signs the UFC, does five more fights, and they're kind of all like this. You know, Vitor Belfort in a slow-paced fight against another aging, slow-paced fighter. Or Vitor Belfort goes over to Bellator, joins the Island of the Misfit Toys over there, where you can just fight anybody, any weight class. I mean, maybe he even shows up looking a little healthier, fights Fedor. Things get crazy. Or they get really crazy. He shows up in Ryzen for New Year's Eve event, and he's in some kind of, you know, tournament over the course of a couple of days. Which one would you actually rather see? Which one do you feel like you would get more enjoyment as a viewer out of?
Just me personally?
Yes.
Probably Bellator, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Just because of all the stuff that you just laid out, all of the options over there. You know, Vitor Belfort could have some stuff to do, even if we got this most recent version of Vitor Belfort, which seems, you know, 40 years old, aging, depleted in the physically, and kind of looking like he's doing that distinctly Vitor Belfort thing where maybe he just doesn't have the confidence, you know, which is also, I would say, a defining characteristic of the Belfort career, is that when he was tuned up and ready to go, there was almost no one more confident in their skills, you know, for 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah, first 3 or 4 minutes.
And then when he's out there, maybe a little bit of a turned down version to what he was at times, you can almost see it, like see a kind of tentative hesitance in the way that he fights. And even if we got that version of Vitor Belfort, I feel like for all parties involved, almost, including Vitor, there would be more interesting and potentially more lucrative stuff to do over in Bellator.
Yeah.
But that brings up the other wrinkle to, like, this whole Vitor Belfort situation, and that is, wasn't it reported leading up to UFC 212 that he actually was not at the end of his UFC contract?
Is that right?
Yeah, so he actually had some stuff to do left over, I think.
Like 5 more fights left on him?
I don't think it's quite a 5 or 6 fight situation, but, like, maybe he had one more after this.
Okay.
And somebody miscounted. I don't know.
That would not shock me, I guess.
Next question this week comes to us from Jason Stevenson. Jason Stevenson, a.k.a. J. Steve.
That makes it easy on everyone.
As a strong supporter of fighters over promotion, fighter collective action, and basic human decency, I find my thoughts and feelings to be in conflict about the plight of one Jermaine Durandamy. While she certainly has the right to accept only the fights she feels are right for her, she is the goddamn champion. My gut feels as if she needs, i.e., should be required to cut the shit and accept that righteous ass whooping before moving down to 135 discourse and make me feel like something more than a depraved monster.
I would say she is not required to take that fight. If she wants to move down to 135 and wants to avoid this fight with Cyborg Justino, she can do that. However, she should not be the least bit surprised if a stigma follows her wherever she goes after this. And, you know, if the penalty is losing her belt and having people think of her as the UFC champion who would rather give up a title than face Cyborg, that's not something that people are going to forget anytime soon. And I think if she goes back to 135, she ends up just being just another person in 135. She's definitely, you know, she's not the champ anymore. And I think she'll just kind of blend back into the crowd only with that negative aura surrounding her probably for the rest of her career. I think that's going to be the punishment for it. But I don't think that you can, you know, make her take that righteous ass whooping if she doesn't want it.
Right, and I agree with you, and especially in this day and age in the sport, it's becoming more and more common, and I guess more and more accepted and acceptable for the fighters to sort of steer their own careers. It's just the way the ship is trending these days.
But there's a difference here.
No, there is a big difference, and it's almost worse, the worst for Jermaine Durandamy, because when you are the champion, but you are not the obvious and generally regarded number one fighter in your weight class, that you're not the best fighter in that organization at that weight, that puts you in an awkward position, at least as like appearances are concerned. It would be like, what if Daniel Cormier was like, you know what? John Jones has disqualified himself from competition one too many times, and I will not fight him again. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and head back up to heavyweight. You don't think people would have some shit to say about Daniel Cormier? You don't think that stigma would follow him everywhere?
I do.
Of course it would.
I do, in fact, think it would.
Of course it would. And with Jermaine Durandamy, it's almost more clear-cut. Because, while I think we all look at John Jones and think probably still the best 205-pound fighter on the planet. We look at Cyborg Justino and we think there is no fucking doubt about it. The best 145-pound woman on the planet.
Well, also, at the moment, she is also like literally the only other person in that division right. for the UFC. And it's one thing, like the thing that I think makes it so different is that it's one thing when you see somebody been toiling for years, trying to climb up that ladder, not making great money. They get the belt, you know, somebody like Tyron Woodley, and then starts looking around and saying, all right, what's the fight that's going to make me the most money right now? Not like hoping for like a payday later on down the road. Give me GSP now. Give me Michael Bisping now. Give me something that's going to get pay-per-view buys up and that is going to put some money in my pocket rather than just looking and seeing who's the next logical contender in my weight class. I understand that because they're trying to make that damn money. But if you're Jermaine Duran to me, there is no other money fight. Then the Cyborg Justino is it. That's the biggest fight you're going to get. And you're not going to go down to 135, you know, unless Ronda Rousey comes back and says, I want Duran to me. you know, Gina Carano comes storming back into MMA and says she, her whole life has been building up to this fight with Jermaine Durandamy at 135. You know, unless something like that happens, there's no way you're going to go down a weight class, give up your belt here and find like a bigger fight or a more profitable fight. This is the fight and you don't want it. And I think we can all see why you don't want it.
Next question this week comes to us from Matthew Webb. He writes, with the induction of Kazushi Sakuraba into the UFC Hall of Fame, along with Maurice Smith, Don Fry, and other fighters who spent the highlight of their careers in other organizations, are entries such as these beginning to legitimize the honor? It seems the UFC is turning their company Hall of Fame into an MMA Hall of Fame, which I believe MMA needs to recognize its greats. Both of you have alluded to the honor as more of an employee of the month award, with the barriers of entry being broadened to other organizations. Does this help legitimize the Hall of Fame this sport deserves or nah? Discourse.
I think it does somewhat. I think that it's a step in the right direction to start using this as a way to honor people who just had great MMA careers and not necessarily great UFC careers. It's a smart move on the UFC's part. I still think, though, that ultimately, if we want it to be regarded as a true Hall of Fame, it can't be the UFC who decides who gets in. The UFC cannot just be like the sole decision maker on this.
Right, because most notably you've got Frank Shamrock hanging out there, not in the UFC Hall of Fame. And any objective mixed martial arts Hall of Fame, I think, would obviously already have Frank Shamrock in it. But I do agree with the general premises here that the UFC Hall of Fame inches closer and closer to legitimacy. And one of the things that I think really helps that, especially as it concerns the induction of Sakuraba into the Hall of Fame. The UFC went like 15 damn minutes on this pay-per-view over the weekend, basically with just a Sakuraba love fest vignette. Lengthy, almost a deep dive into the guy's legendary MMA career, which I did not expect. I would not have expected the UFC to do that. And it was nice.
Yeah,
I
thought guys like Moro Ronaldo on it. Yeah,
it was a nice gesture, I thought. And that makes it seem legitimate, makes it seem a little bit more, you know, like an actual thing rather than just, like we've said before, an employee of the month club. I mean, as long as you have a corporate run Hall of Fame that one organization in the world of mixed martial arts is the steward of, I think you're always going to have some gray areas and some questions to ask about what it actually means to be in the Hall of Fame. But yeah, putting a dude like Sakuraba, who I think only fought twice in the UFC, in there based mostly on his achievements in Japan, I think is a nice gesture and a good move for the UFC. And I think, it seems to me like we can credit Ant Evans with the UFC at the UFC for kind of taking these steps to, kind of drag the Hall of Fame into an era of legitimacy.
Yeah, and it seems like no one, at least based on like my conversations with them, no one in the world seems to care more about this Hall of Fame than Ann Evans does, and takes it seriously and wants it to be taken seriously. And so, you know, I'm sure that he's a voice of reason over there when it comes to some of these decisions. And these are smart moves to move it in that direction. But, you know, you just see that the UFC, like the top honchos in the UFC, have such a habit of getting into these long feuds that it sometimes just get incredibly petty with former fighters and even current fighters, that it's hard not to imagine that you're going to continue to see these situations pop up where somebody seems like they should deserve entry into it, and just because they don't get along with Dana White, that's going to keep them out. And if that continues to happen, that will hurt it.
You know what will be really fun is if Sakuraba shows up for the presentation, for the ceremony. And I assume he will, unless he's got a fight, right?
Yeah, what else has he got to do? Going to show up in a mask, take it off, another mask underneath?
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I would expect some theatrics.
And they, you know, if they still do that thing, they sometimes do those speeches at like 11 o'clock in the morning during one of those big like fight weeks in Las Vegas. Maybe have a couple few soda pops before you get up there. We could all have a good time.
Last question this week comes to us from Zach, the prosecutor. He writes, Black Beast versus Mark Hunt coming up next Saturday. Is it possible, after the recent bad-mouthing by Mr. Hunt of the UFC suits, that their plan is actually to get him killed inside the octagon? Gentlemen, discuss. Ben, this is the main event of Fight Night 110 coming to us this weekend from Auckland, New Zealand, which is Mark Hunt's stomping grounds. That's the home territory for the Super Samoan, taking on Derek Lewis at heavyweight in the main event in a fight that, unless someone pulls a fast one, seems like it will be an incredible slugfest for all of our viewing pleasure, and at least for Derek Lewis, kind of an important stepping stone in his continued quest to nab a heavyweight title shot.
Yeah, I mean, I have to reject the assertion that anybody's trying to get Mark Hunt killed, because that implies that anybody could know what's going to happen in this fight, and you can't. With two fighters, especially these two fighters going out there right now, there's no way anybody can look at it and be like, I am 100% certain this happens. I mean, you look at the odds and it's, you know, basically a toss-up, as it should be. Either one of these guys can connect and knock the other one's head clean off at any single moment in this fight. So, I don't know. It just seems to me like a good kind of logical piece of matchmaking. And it also seems like Mark Hunt has been on this thing lately where he just wants to get his fights over and done with and be done with his UFC contract.
This is an important fight for Derek Lewis. As I talked about a second ago, clearly the only thing we have seen from him in his UFC career is a sort of devil may care, throw down type attitude. Any chance at all that Derek Lewis does pull a fast one here, approaches this fight with a game plan of not just going out there and throwing hillbilly haymakers with Mark Hunt?
You're saying goes out there, you know, knuckles up and then shoots a double?
I'm talking about a flashback to November 2010 when Derek Lewis beat Rakeem Cleveland via submission armbar at Worldwide Gladiator.
Wow, look at you. Deep cuts.
If you're scoring at home, that is the last time that a Derek Lewis fight ended in something other than a decision or a KO.
Huh. All right. Well, hey, I'm not going to say I think it's terribly likely, but if he comes out there and just like Imanari roll straight to submission there, then maybe we'll have to all recognize that Chad Dundas called it.
Flying triangle.
Okay. All right.
That's going to do it for listener mail this week. If you have a question, a comment, a concern that you would like to air to the Co-Main Event podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. You go to the website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says Email the Podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. While you're there, you can sign up for the Breakfast of Champions newsletter. That comes out every Friday morning. It catches you up on the news and notes that we miss on all the days that we're not recording the podcast. Stuff always happens. News always breaks. The newsletter itself is short. It's informative. We would like to think that it's occasionally funny. And if you don't like it, it's really easy to unsubscribe. As for right now, though, we're going to go ahead and get started with round number one. Well, Ben, as people can probably guess from earlier in the show, we're going to go ahead and break the main event of UFC 212 up over two rounds of this episode of the Co-Main Event Podcast, both because I think Max Holloway's victory over Jose Aldo in the featherweight title unification bout deserves it, and also because short of Claudia Gadella's kind of quick victory over Karolina Kovalkiewicz, and maybe the Derek Lewis Mark Hunt fight coming up this weekend, not a lot of other shit going on.
No.
So we're going to go ahead and give what I believe is what Jose Aldo sort of deserves on this podcast, to talk a little bit about his career, where he has been, and where he goes from here after a third round TKO loss to Max Holloway at UFC 212. And let me start you off with this question that I asked at the top of the show. Obviously, Jose Aldo has been a tremendous champion for the UFC, was one of the most feared guys in the entire sport for a lot of years as he ruled the featherweight division with an iron fist. It feels to me like that loss to Conor McGregor and then the loss to Max Holloway in two of his last three fights may be a big part of what ends up defining his legacy, which I don't necessarily like. I don't think that it's fair or nice to say about a guy of Jose Aldo's stature, but at the same time, I feel like those images are going to be there when we think about his career.
Well, one thing worth noting is that his career is not over yet.
Sure, he can keep going.
Well,
I would argue also that this loss to Max Holloway, maybe even more than the McGregor loss, pushes him into a different period of his career.
It definitely seems to, and that's why this seemed more like a sign of a major transition than that McGregor loss did. Because in that one, you know, he gets fired up, he charges forward, heats a left hand, and he gets knocked out. And you can say, well, he got so worked up with all this pre-fight hype with McGregor that he kind of forgot his basics and ran right into trouble. And that can happen to anybody if you screw up. And this one, you know, he looked good in the first round, and Max Holloway just kind of stood there, took what he had, and managed to figure out a way to victory, and then just really put a beat down on him there to finish that fight. And it was way more of a case where it looked like these guys can fight again, and that it'll probably look a lot like that again. It seemed like one guy who had peaked and was kind of beginning the downslope of his career, and another guy on his way up. And so that, I think, is why that one felt like way more of a shift than just the one knockout. And I mean, you know, he already issued a statement basically saying, I'm going to be back. You know, if this happens, you get knocked down, you get back up. And so who knows what the future holds for him. But it does seem like it's not – like if you take away the Conor McGregor one, if it's just this one where he had a run where he had the title for like, what, you know, six, seven years?
6 years.
And then – a 25-year-old fighter who's been tearing it up since, you know, he was basically in the UFC when he was in middle school, pretty much. And he comes along on this great winning streak and he beats you. That would not look so different than what we've come to expect out of the fighter and even champion life cycle, that you can hold it down for a long time and then eventually somebody comes around and they beat you. And that's just how it goes.
Right. And with Jose Aldo, I wonder if the changing competition, the competitive nature of the division, the changes that we've seen at featherweight over the last couple years have anything to do with that. You're talking about a guy who had 15 straight wins from the time that he signed with the WEC back in 2008 to the time that he lost to McGregor at UFC 194 in just 13 seconds. And there were a lot of highlights, you know, in the interim for Jose Aldo, like just cut a swath through the WEC, frankly. The 8-second double flying knee KO of Cub Swanson, his TKO against Mike Brown to win the title, and then obviously whipping up on Uriah Faber at WEC 48 in that organization's only pay-per-view fight. And then he comes to the UFC. He beats Chad Mendez twice. He beats Frankie Edgar twice. He has that fight with Chan Sung Jung. He beats basically everybody that he comes across, and then drops these two to McGregor and Holloway. And you look back on the people that Jose Aldo beat, and obviously it's an impressive list, but at the same time, I wonder, you know, there just weren't a lot of fighters like Conor McGregor and Max Holloway in the division during what you might, in retrospect, consider Jose Aldo's heyday. Like, he's cleaning up on, as Conor McGregor quipped, midgets before their fight, a lot of grappling-based opponents, and then you get these two longer, bigger guys for that weight class who are very skilled strikers, and Aldo ends up losing. Like, obviously, we can debate the fluky nature of the 13-second knockout all we want, but I wonder if the evolution of the sport had anything to do with Aldo's kind of demise, or if that by 30 years old and 29 fights into his career, if he had was starting to show a little age.
Yeah, that's possible, but then I go back to UFC 200 and that win that he had over Frankie Edgar, and you look at just some of the like individual exchanges that he had in that fight, and that definitely does not look like a fighter who's had it, like a washed up fighter there.
No.
You know, you look at what Frankie Edgar continues to do, and everybody still pretty hot on Frankie Edgar, thinking that that's one of the best fighters in the division. And when he went up against Jose Aldo, couldn't seem to do anything that he wanted to do against him. So, I mean, some of that might be, you know, style differences. I think a lot of it just has to be credit to Max Holloway, who put on a hell of a fight, because there were some moments there in that first round where you see in those brief flashes that just sudden, terrifying violence version of Jose Aldo. And Max Holloway took those shots, you know, took them clean on the jaw. And then in the next round, is still standing there with his hands down, taunting him just to try and draw him out so you can counter him. And that takes kind of balls of steel and a lot of confidence in your skills if you're Max Holloway. So I think that he deserves credit more than Jose Aldo deserves, like, scorn, as if he just completely went out there and laid an egg.
Sure, yeah. And we'll talk about Max Holloway in round number two. I guess the obvious next place to go with Jose Aldo is, what do you do with him now? Like, he's obviously going to be a step removed from the title picture for a little while. The world kind of opens up for Max Holloway here at 145 pounds. Even despite the fact that he's beat a lot of the top 10 featherweights already, there are still some fresh matchups for him there. Assuming that Jose Aldo wants to continue on and fight in this division, in this company, What's the best thing to do with him here? Me personally, I look at this list, I think maybe Cubby Sampson.
You know, that's one I think it kind of depends what you think you want to do with the title picture and who you want to give that next title shot to. Because if you want to go Frankie Edgar versus Max Holloway, then I think it makes sense to run another one between Jose Aldo and Cub Swanson. Just because you know there's some part of Cub. I mean, I know Cub Swanson's been making his case for the title shot, but you know there's a part of him that would love to go out there and prove that he was better than he looked in that fight, that WEC fight with Jose Aldo. And that's a crackerjack of a fight.
Right.
You know, you might end up on the undercard of a pay-per-view or the headlining fight of a UFC fight night from Manaus somewhere. But that's a fight that I think everybody would watch, and it gives you a good fighter who's known for putting on exciting fights, but who's also going to serve as kind of a litmus test to help people find out, like, okay, is this the beginning of a downward depressing slide for you, or was it a bad night against a really good fighter?
Right. And Jose Aldo is to Cub Swanson, perhaps, as Conor McGregor is to Jose Aldo. Like, that's his crushing 8-second knockout loss. So you got to think that Swanson would want to get that one back. Clearly, Ben, one of the things that's hampered Jose Aldo throughout his career is this thing where he slows down as fights go on. It happened to him, you know, more times than once in the UFC. And I know that there's always been talk of him moving up to lightweight, and I know that it sounds somewhat counterproductive to say in two breaths, like, well, he just got beat by these two bigger guys in Max Holloway and Conor McGregor, so is the right move really to go up to 155? But I also wonder, if you're Aldo and you're not doing this weight cut to get down to 145, do you have an easier time being Jose Aldo for 3 or 5 rounds if you don't have to do that weight cut?
And are you trying to talk me into Jose Aldo versus Justin Gaethje at some point in the future?
I mean,
is that what you're doing?
You start looking at this list of lightweights, and, you know, once again, there's just not too many bad fights on there, man. Nate Diaz, Michael Chiesa, Michael Johnson, Edson Barbosa, Al Iaquinta, Kevin Lee, like,
man, Jose Aldo versus Ally. Can you just take my money? Shut up and take my money.
Well, Sir Nigel Longstock is here. We're going to do a little Master Tweet Theater. It's been a couple weeks since we did that. It'll be good to catch up with him. So he's going to come take my chair. I'm going to slide over there and share a mic with Ben Foulkes, which I don't like to do, but such is the way when you're a mom and pop shop recording this thing at somebody's kitchen table. And that starts right now.
Well, it's that time again. We welcome back to the show friend of the podcast and noted theatricalist, Sir Nigel Longstock. Sir Nigel, how are you?
Good day to you, sir. I am moist with perspiration.
I wish you hadn't said that. Damp. I really do.
Damp with perspiration?
It's not getting any better. So I assume that you've brought us some tweets with some kind of half-assed theme?
I certainly have here, sir. The theme is hard truths.
Okay. That guarantees that there will be some easy lies, at least in two of the five tweets.
simple negation will not get you very far.
It'll probably get me pretty far, actually. Whenever you're ready, go ahead and hit us with the first one.
Yes, let us begin. This episode of Master Tweet Theater is brought to you by Good Boy Astronauts, the cigarette for dogs, adult dogs. Puppies can't handle the rich taste of Good Boy Astronauts, which come in adult dog flavors like coffee filter, flip-flop, and cheese. Good Boy Astronauts, not until you're 2.5.
Why do I feel like this particular sponsor is now just throwing astronaut into any possible combination of words?
It's a hot brand. It's the new eye.
Yeah, no, it is true that in the year 2017, there's no hotter brand than the astronaut.
True, true. Let us begin, shall we?
Let us.
Tweet the first. Anthony Joshua is pretty darn impressive, but he's no Baruto.
Oh, wow. This is from like an actual fighter, not just like a regular run-of-the-mill CME fan. Chad, did you tweet this? Is this you?
It's not me.
I'm going to guess Chad Dundas.
That's your guess?
No.
Because I would know that if it were, I mean, in theory.
It sounds, though, like it could be a Chad Dundas tweet. You'd be proud of yourself if you came up with that tweet.
And it would also involve me knowing who Anthony Joshua is.
The boxer?
Is he a boxer? Okay.
I'm not sure. Isn't Anthony Joshua the bad guy in Lethal Weapon? Mr. Joshua?
That is Mr. Joshua. Ah. You will address him as such with his desired title. So it's got to be somebody who kind of has a little bit of a sense of humor, plugged into what's going on with the MMA fans on the internet. Joe Benavidez.
What about media? Can we have media on here? Yes. Be a media member?
You may have media and non-human corporate entities. Hint, hint.
Oh, now you come with that, huh?
So you think this might actually be Ryzen? This might be Ryzen FF?
Is that your guess?
That's my guess.
It is! It is Ryzen Fighting Federation!
Whew, I got a real assist there.
So even Ryzen is now in on the joke that Boruto sucks, but we're going to pretend like he's good?
It would appear so.
Okay. All right, I'm into it.
Bite your tongue, man.
Big thanks.
These tabletop microphones are great for sharing a mic, by the way.
Yeah, it's very intimate.
Much better than before.
It's like that scene in Lady and the Tramp where they're both eating the same piece of spaghetti. Big thanks to Twitter user @MagpieMcGraw for this tip.
Are you sure this is a real Ryzen account and you guys didn't just get trolled?
I'm not even sure Magpie McGraw is a real person.
Okay.
Tweet the second. If you be know this movie, you're not hard, bro. #Lionheart, #Bloodsport, #VanDamme, #VanDamage, @Jean-Claude Van Damme.
So am I to understand that what is happening here is somebody is tweeting @VanDamme saying that if you don't know this movie, then you're not hard. And by this movie, they mean two different Van Damme movies.
Indeed. And your is YOUR. So it's possible the tweet is, if you be know this movie, you're not hard, bro. And then he forgot to sign it. I don't know. It's a typo.
Chad?
A lot of candidates here. Could be Vanderlei Silva. Could be Hanzo Gracie, who Sir Nigel likes to sneak on every now and then. I'm gonna go back with our old friend Vanderlei Silva here.
God damn, it does feel like a Vanderlei Silva tweet. I'm gonna go to Ruto Ishihara.
Both fine guesses, both exploiters of the your problem, and both wrong. It is Nick Diaz.
What?
Tweeting at Jean-Claude Van Damme to tip him off to a sweet Jean-Claude Van Damme movie.
Which is actually two different movies.
Mm-hmm. At least two. Lionheart, Bloodsport. Is Van Damage a movie or just a cool tagline?
I think just a cool tagline, but you could kind of convince me of either. Wait, so Nick Diaz, I didn't even think Nick Diaz tweets very much. Do you know like what time of day this tweet was sent? Please tell me it's like 3 a.m.
I assume it was sent at 4:21, sir.
Okay, fair enough.
He got started at 4:15, though, so a little early. Tweet the third. I bet more plants are edible than we think. Sometimes I'm tempted to eat my hosta.
This is a hard truth.
To be fair, I was going to give the tweeter in question some hard truth by pointing out that hostas are toxic, but then with a little research I found that they're not.
So we all learned something.
Yeah, go ahead and eat hostas. It's a misconception that they will kill you. Maybe. I don't know. Check that out for yourself and take responsibility.
Okay. I'm going to say Jason High, KC Bandit.
Interesting. What's a hosta?
A hosta is a semi-tropical plant. It's very hardy. It's got spade-shaped leaves, green, sometimes with white stripes.
Nerd.
It's a popular houseplant.
But I have noticed I follow Jason High on Instagram, and he's gotten really into like home gardening lately. Oh. So that's my guess.
That's a good guess. There's some evidence there. I'm going to go Uriah Faber.
Both fine guesses, both amateur horticulturalists, and both wrong. It is Felice Herring.
Okay. All right. Felice no way Herring. Anybody was going
to
know that.
Nope.
I'm thinking of starting to pronounce it Felice.
Don't do that.
Felice Herring.
Let's move on.
Okay. Tweet the fourth. This tweet is in conversation with the following tweet, the fifth tweet. So this is the first one in the chain of conversation, but it's going to seem a little strange because it's responding to another tweet that's fairly boring. We did not include.
Okay.
Tweet the fourth. Cool. Shoot me a text when you're in NYC and let's sharpen the guns. I got to work on my mental. Making mistakes in a fight, even one, leads to disaster.
Okay. That's somebody in NYC. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, or someone visiting NYC?
Okay. But they're saying, like, let me know when you're in NYC, so they would probably be kind of always around there. Ally Quinta.
I'm going to go the poet Philip Baroni here.
Both fine guesses, both stereotypical New Yorkers, and both wrong. It is Oluwole Bumbose.
Come on.
The Bang Bus.
Come on.
Can I hear that tweet one more time?
Yes. Shoot me a text when you're in NYC and let's sharpen the guns. I gotta work on my mental. Making mistakes in a fight, even one, leads to disaster.
Even one.
Yes.
Felt we made one mistake.
Just one. And he's gotta work on his mental.
Yeah.
Also, do not sharpen your guns.
All right, and this leads us to the fifth tweet, I guess?
Indeed. Tweet the fifth. In response to the previous tweet, it wasn't mental. It was straight cardio, lol. But you never text me back, lol.
Jed, you have any guesses here?
Could this be the fellow that the Bang Bus just fought?
Do you know that fellow's name?
Borrachina?
Borrachina?
Borrachino. Yes, Brazilian Superman, as I recall.
Sir Nigel's reaction tells me maybe that's not him.
I gave it away. Damn my expressive eyes.
I wonder who could get in there and help him sharpen the guns. I'm going to say Eve Edwards.
Both fine guesses, both likely gun sharpeners, and both wrong. It is Platinum Mike Perry.
Platinum Mike Perry did kind of drop some hard truths there, I got to say. I'm surprised.
So wait a second. You want Platinum Mike Perry to come up to NYC and work on your mental? That's
help you sharpen the guns?
Sharpening the gun. Okay. All right.
Man, I would pay good money to see Platinum Mike Perry and Oluwole Bumbose sitting around there sharpening some goddamn guns. You know what I'm saying?
I bet he stops using the N-word that whole weekend.
Probably not. That's it for Master Tweet Theater. What else you got going on, Sir Nigel?
You know, it's funny you should ask, sir. I've just finished shooting an exciting new project about a ruthless oil baron who steadily loses his humanity in the relentless pursuit of the Kumite.
I see him. What's it called?
It's called There Will Be Bloodsport.
And what role do you play?
I play the guy from the Bangkok Athletic Commission who makes sure there's no funny business while they're dipping their hands in broken glass.
Of course you do. Well, that was Master Tweet Theater, and that was Sir Nigel Longstone.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Chad, well, it was undeniably a little bit of a downer to see Jose Aldo fall and fall hard from the throne at featherweight. On the flip side, there's your boy Jerome Max Holloway, 25 years old, goes out there, puts an ass whipping on Jose Aldo, and then is flaunting his platinum tie in the press conference, telling everybody, surprise, surprise, Max Holloway is the man now at featherweight. And he's feeling it. You can tell this man is feeling it. And I gotta say, I was very excited by the performance. I was excited by the matchup beforehand, but then seeing the way he kind of wears it afterwards, I start to think, you know what? Max Holloway can do some business as the featherweight champ.
Yeah, there's a lot to like about Max Holloway as far as I'm concerned, even though I think you're right. It was somewhat depressing to see Jose Aldo dispatched, I think, because we're not used to seeing him like that, really. And then we've seen it in two out of his last three fights, and he does seem to take it so hard. Like, Jose Aldo, he's not out there playing games. He takes these losses to his heart, and you can tell that right away. And so that's always sad to see. But, you know, on the other hand, 25-year-old Max Holloway does seem poised to do some stuff at 145. I liked the entire performance, man. I even liked him saying, if you want to be a king, you got to do king stuff before this fight. You got to go to the other king's village and take everything he's got.
King stuff.
And then he shows up with the mirrored tie, the hexagonal mirrored tie.
Yeah, we won't point out that you're just, you know, would have been real easy to make that an octagon tie, but okay, fine.
Who knows? Maybe it's not easy.
maybe
Max Holloway's dope-ass suit guy tried to make that an octagon, and it's just not humanly possible.
Maybe he was sitting there crafting the octagon tie, and he got a cease and desist letter. Said, you know what? I'll show you. You're not the only multi-sided shape out there. I think one of the things that is really exciting when you think about what Max Holloway might be able to do as champion is how he went out there and won this fight, because it involved him doing kind of a little bit of everything. Like, he took some hard shots from Jose Aldo in that first round. Didn't even change the expression on his face. I was kind of waiting when seeing, you know, the first round not really going his way. He took a few hard combinations where Jose Aldo just exploding forward and hammering him. And I was kind of waiting to see the look on his face like, oh shit, maybe this guy really is better than I thought he was. Maybe he's as good as, you know, the hype reels say he is. And then he comes out in that second round, and by the time he gets a little more comfortable in the fight and settles into it, he's having fun by the end of that second round. You know, he's playing his game, but by the time he's in the third round, he's got Jose Aldo a step behind trying to catch up with him, you know, trying to counter his own, swinging and missing and looking foolish. And then he goes ahead and puts him down with punches, jumps on him on the mat, and just overwhelms him. You know, when you can do all that stuff and you start to look at who else you might end up in a fight against at featherweight, this seems like somebody who has the skills to hold it down for a little while.
Yeah, what does he have, 11 wins in a row now? That's pretty impressive. And a guy who clearly has improved a great deal since, as you said, he showed up in the UFC basically straight out of middle school and lost his debut to Dustin Poirier at UFC 143 and then, you know, won three fights in a row but had the back-to-back losses to Dennis Bermudez and Conor McGregor especially. Since then, he just appears to have really put things together and as his performances, I think, dictate, closed a lot of holes. Like you say, you go out there, you see him go out there and, you know, struggle early against Jose Aldo, but eventually score this third round TKO, and you start to wonder, what are this guy's weaknesses? At 25 years old and room to grow and right in his athletic prime, I agree with you. It seems like Max Holloway is raring to go for a nice run at featherweight here. And that brings up, you know, a potential fight against Frankie Edgar, a potential fight against Cub Swanson. I even feel like just because of the awesomeness of the matchup at Styles, Yair Rodriguez is back in the mix a little bit, even after that kind of demoralizing loss to Frankie Edgar. You see that kid get a couple of wins in a row, and I wouldn't be surprised to see Max Holloway and Rodriguez do the damn thing at some point. What's the best thing to do with Max Holloway right now, and then I guess moving forward?
Well, I think I would be genuinely curious to see him against Frankie Edgar right now. And I think that you can also then start to make the case that if he goes out there and he beats Frankie Edgar, then, you know, not only is he on like a 12-fight win streak in one of the deepest divisions that the UFC has, but he also goes from beating Jose Aldo to Frankie Edgar. That's kind of a little bit of a Legends ass-whooping tour right there. You know, you can, marketing-wise, if you're the UFC, if you're paying attention, you can work with that. I think that would also give some of the younger fighters, like you mentioned, guys like Yair Rodriguez, or even guys like the Korean Superboy, it'll give some of those guys a chance to build up their credentials a little bit. Because I think right now you do see a little bit of a gap where you have kind of an old guard and a young guard at featherweight, and there's a lot of exciting young guys, but they seem to be not quite there yet. I think Legends ass whooping might be the way to go.
Can we talk about the Irish elephant in the room?
Do we even need to? He's not coming back. I mean, that's one. I wrote my post-fight column on this because with Jose Aldo as the champion, I always have to smirk a little bit when I would hear them say undisputed, because it is kind of by its nature not undisputed. I mean, there was an interim champ for one thing. That's kind of a dispute in itself. But also, when the guy got knocked out by somebody, lost a featherweight title, then that guy left. McGregor leaves, just kind of like is forced to set the title down. And it's like Jose Aldo almost comes along and finds it and puts it around his waist. You know, it was hard to feel like that was the total, unquestioned, legitimate champ. Although now Max Holloway goes out there and he beats Jose Aldo. And the fact that we have to say with a straight face, it is more likely that Conor McGregor will make his pro boxing debut against Floyd Mayweather than it is that he will come back down to featherweight and fight Max Holloway for the title. Like, just because it seems so unlikely to happen, I think we got to forget about him as far as this division goes.
A lot of doors have to slam in the face of Conor McGregor, I think, before it even begins to make sense for him to fight Max Holloway. Because once again, and like you said, we kind of had the vibe immediately after the Jose Aldo knockout that maybe Conor McGregor was done at featherweight. Now you have a situation with Max Holloway where, once again, you have an incredibly difficult fight for what would be probably the smallest payout of any on the table. And as we know well and good by now, that's just not the way Conor McGregor operates. How big of a bummer is that though, right? Like, it's hard for me, even though we already know he's probably not coming back to 145, if even coming back to the UFC after his like protracted paternity leave and vision quest is over. but I, you know, you watch Max Holloway go out there and he's got this style and he fights Jose Aldo. And then you think, man, how sweet would it be to see him now at 25 years old rematch Conor McGregor?
That would be sweet. And now you got me thinking about how many doors exactly would have to slam. Like maybe if Conor McGregor loses three fights in a row, you know, his flame-throwing car gets repossessed. He falls on really just financially hard times to where, like, he's just out there, like, his Versace robe is dirty and he's sleeping on the sidewalk.
And all unkempt.
And he comes off a bad bout of the flu, so he already kind of naturally gets down closer to 145. Then maybe he fights Max Holloway. Short of that, don't see it happening.
Yeah. An unforeseen skid financially for Conor McGregor.
Or in retrospect might start to seem like a totally foreseeable VH1 Behind the Music style skid. Who knows?
Out on the streets of Dublin trying to sell El Chapo shirts, right?
I mean, hey, I might buy one if the price is right.
All right, well, let's do Are You Fucking Kidding Me in that, Ben, and then we can move on to round number three. Ben, what's your Are You Fucking Kidding Me for this week?
Well, Chad, I don't know if you saw this, but on the prelims of UFC 212, Brian Kelleher, he might have made an argument for being one of my guys because he goes out there against Yuri Alcantara. For one thing, gets the fastest tap I think I've ever seen on an arm in guillotine choke off a takedown, where like it just seems like no sooner has he locked it up and locks it up in the kind of position where we've seen where usually it seems like more hope than technique is involved. And immediately Yuri Alcantara is tapping. Brazilian fans aren't crazy about it, in part because Brian Kelleher does the sweet ass move of jumping up on top of the cage. And at first he does the thing where he like puts the hands together in that, like, I want to make friends with this hostile crowd praying motion, but then immediately transitions from that to the finger to the lips. Shh, everybody be quiet now. Which then leads to a prolonged yelling fest, during his post-fight interview with Brian Stan, in which we learn Brian Kelleher is from Long Island.
Uh-oh.
And is ready to do the damn thing. Give him 50 G's, change his life, and he's out. Next thing you know, I'm going, did I just become a Brian Kelleher fan? Are you fucking kidding me? You
fucking kidding me?
All that, like a minute and 48 seconds worth of work in the octagon. That's how you do the shit, people.
Wait, is that the rare positive? Are you fucking kidding me?
The rare positive. Are you fucking kidding me?
Well, I'm not going positive with mine, Ben, because did you see your boy Vitor Belfort running around everywhere in Rio de Janeiro with a damn service dog?
I heard something about a dog.
In his toe? I mean, I guess I don't know what Vitor Belfort's got going on. Maybe he's got some problems that I'm unaware of. He did say that he needs the dog because he gets quote unquote nervous on flights. But at the same time, it totally seemed like maybe Vitor Belfort just wanted a dog to play with. Cause the way he describes it, he's like, ah, she keeps me company on trips. And then every scene of Vitor Belfort in the UFC embedded series is him playing with this damn dog, brings it to the weigh-ins on stage with him, gets up there, weighs in, telling the dog to do all of its tricks. When I think person that needs a service dog, this is all I'm saying. when I think of the services rendered by a service dog in our society, I don't necessarily think that Vitor Belfort getting nervous on flights is my top need. That's all I'm saying.
How about, like, can I have a service dog that goes with me into Target because the service I need is that I hate going into Target alone?
I mean, that's how it seems with the Vitor Belfort service dog. Like, whatever you need, man.
Fucking kidding me.
Are you fucking kidding me? Need a dog to come to the dentist with me, curl up on my lap so I don't get too nervous?
I mean, that's actually a good idea.
Anyway, that's going to do it for round number two. We'll be right back with round number three. Ben, close observers of mixed martial arts, or perhaps journalists who have covered mixed martial arts for a number of years, were probably not all that surprised to read about the various behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing surrounding the next fight for Demetrius Johnson, the UFC flyweight champion, because I think, you know, as you read through this this lengthy statement that he posted on the internet, I think you see a lot of what I would describe as standard UFC moves in terms of relating to the talent or basically negotiating anything with anybody. The thing that I thought was surprising or most surprising about it is that it's Demetrius Johnson out here airing these grievances, which to me, my immediate thought was, man, if you have pissed off Demetrius Johnson so bad that he is putting you on blast in the public arena, you have messed up, because this is a guy that we have almost never heard a cross word for the UFC from throughout his career, and now suddenly he's sick of it. He's had it up to here. And so I think that made almost everything that he said in his account have the ring of truth, and I think that it immediately kind of puts the public on his side here in this dispute.
Well, not only does it, the way that it came out, like who it comes from, give it the ring of truth, but that when you start to hear him describing exactly how the UFC was trying to do him and negotiating what was going to be this next fight, it sounds like exactly some shit you can imagine the UFC doing. And if the UFC wants to get into a situation where Dana White has to say, hey, who are you going to believe, me or Demetrius Johnson? One of them has a better reputation for honesty and forthrightness than the other.
Right. We have no reason to think at any point yet Demetrius Johnson has led us astray.
That's
about
right.
Anything.
That's
right.
Whereas on the contrary,
we've got 15 years.
There's a lot of evidence that Dana White will just straight up lie to you. So, but I think when you dig down into what he's saying, it especially gets hard to, for me to figure out what the UFC thinks the end game is here with Demetrius Johnson, and how you even get into this situation, because you have a guy who just sheer talent-wise might be the best fighter in the sport, definitely one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the sport, definitely the most dominant champion that you have. By the end of it all, might be, you know, have the longest and most impressive title reign ever in the UFC, and you... Not only do you kind of make an enemy out of him by jerking him around a little bit in terms of who you want him to fight, but it seems like you're kind of going out of your way in some of these instances to be like, hey, he's unmarketable, unpromotable, and you're the promoter. Like, your job is to sell him. It's like if I'm trying to sell you a car and I'm getting frustrated that it's difficult for me to sell it, so I go on and on about what a shitty car it is, and then I'm surprised when nobody wants to buy it after that. Like, it just makes you wonder, what are you thinking here if this is the tactic you're going with one of the best champs that you have?
It kills me when I hear anyone, particularly the UFC, say that Demetrius Johnson is unpromotable or not promotable, because every time someone says that, whether they say it about like Demetrius Johnson being hard to promote, or they say it about him needing to put himself out there more, or they say it about his fighting style, I'm like, have you ever talked to him? Have you ever watched him fight even one time? Because I'll tell you something. This is a dude that before he became a professional fighter worked at a factory and then transformed himself with the aid of Matt Hume into essentially the perfect mixed martial arts fighter. And then after his last fight, title defense number 10, I believe, gets on the mic and says that he is a better fighter than George St. Pierre and Anderson Silva. Said that shit on the mic. And you're telling me you can't tell a story about this guy? I don't know, man. This seems like day one stuff. Well, like MMA promoter day one stuff.
And not to mention, if you look at like his popularity with like the gaming community as like an online streamer of games, and it's like, okay, there's an audience for him. They're out there if you know how to find them and you know how to reach them and not just do the same thing you like to do with everybody, where when he's got a fight coming up, suddenly you got Joe Rogan talking about how he's the pound for pound greatest and nobody's ever seen anything like him in generations. And then as soon as that's over with, you forget about him and somebody else is the pound for pound greatest when you need, like, you know, you're just doing that kind of one size fits all approach to promoting. But like you said, and I think that it's easier really. Like, maybe if there's a way to get fans behind him, it's seeing him in opposition to the UFC. Like, when he kind of gets in this don't-give-a-fuck mode, both about fans and about the UFC, then I think he becomes a lot more interesting. But I cannot say that's anything I think the UFC is doing on purpose. But then this is a quote I saw on Ian Kidd's Twitter from his appearance on the MMA Hour today. This is a quote from Demetrius Johnson. They said it's either TJ, meaning TJ Dillashaw, or we close the flyweight division. I said close the motherfucking division then. I mean, that's the kind of stuff fans are going to be able to get interested in. But then if that's the UFC's approach to trying to get Demetrius Johnson to do the fight they want him to do in the next moment, and from his account, they changed their idea about what fight they wanted him to do based on what was going on, then if you're some other flyweight, if you know, this is a division that the UFC has had now for a few years, and you hear, wait a minute, they were threatening to close this entire division that I fight in just because Demetrius Johnson didn't want to do one fight that they wanted him to do. What am I doing? What can it really happen that easily? Dana White just gets mad and suddenly the whole division goes away. That's where you start to realize like maybe a few people have too much power over this sport.
The two areas where I most empathized with Demetrius Johnson in this dispute, in this statement that he released, which I guess we should say again, is just his side of the argument. We have yet to hear really what the UFC's side is.
Well, they started, right? I mean, Dana White went on the UFC Unfiltered, which, by the way, Unfiltered, I looked at its website and it bills itself as the official podcast of the UFC. So
filtered.
Kind of filtered.
Pretty filtered.
But that's how this whole thing started, was him going on there and saying, hey, he won't fight TJ Dillashaw. It's insanity. This is his chance to make points on the pay-per-view and he won't do it. Wonder why. You know, kind of like heavily implying that he's scared to fight TJ Dillashaw. And then Demetrius Johnson comes back with like a 2,000 word, barely clear, like not only did it make a lot of good points, but barely clearly laid out throughout. And then he summarizes in bullet points at the end, just in case you didn't get it.
The two places where I most empathized with Demetrius Johnson were, one, that he didn't want to fight Ray Borg at first. He wanted to fight Sergio Pettis, and they said, no, Ray Borg. And he said, okay, Ray Borg, and then started getting ready for Ray Borg. And then they came back to him and said, no, TJ Dillashaw, because Cody Garbrandt just got hurt. I think we've all had a situation like this, right? Where we feel as we already compromised with someone, and then they circle back later and is like, no, we're doing a different thing. So number one, I was like, oh, I know that feeling. Demetrius Johnson, I know that feeling. And the second part, and this is the part that in retrospect and after his appearance on the MMA Hour today really seemed to piss off Demetrius Johnson, was when he's talking to Dana White. By his account, Dana White basically says, you need to do this for TJ Dillashaw. Like, this is a thing that we're doing for TJ. He deserves it and you need to do it for him. Which, if you are the reigning UFC flyweight champion, 10 fucking title defenses deep in this historic reign of yours, that is going to piss you right off.
Yeah.
That we're going to do this for TJ.
Yeah. Why? What's so important? Does TJ have like leukemia or something? And I don't know about it. Like, we're all like banding together to make TJ's dream come true. Yeah. I agree with you. That would throw me into a sudden rage as well. And also, as he said in that statement, like, hey, if I'm going to fight a guy coming down from bantamweight, why aren't I waiting to go ahead and fight Cody Garbrandt, who said he wants to do that? I mean, that's the one that would really be a big fight. Like, the champion from bantamweight comes down to fight the champion from flyweight. There you have yourself one of those super fights things that we're always promised and so rarely get. Why wouldn't you do that one instead of like, well, you know, this guy had a cup of coffee with the belt, and now he doesn't have it anymore, but the other dude is hurt. We need to make a fight. We want to help him out for some reason, and he's going to go ahead and take the fight. And still Demetrius Johnson was saying, would have taken the fight, but I was concerned about his ability to make the weight. And so I wanted certain guarantees, because if he doesn't make the weight, then it's a non-title fight. And then, you know, that whole quest to break the record has to be delayed. And so he wants this kind of financial guarantees in case TJ Dillashaw can't make a weight that he has never proven that he can make, which seems reasonable enough. And the UFC says no. Basically, the UFC keeps asking for stuff, and every time Demetrius Johnson asks for kind of anything, asks them to compromise on anything in order to get what they want, they say no. I don't blame him for being pissed off.
No, me either. And if anything, I think that this illustrates, again, like through one small example, that there's always, you know, a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes in this sport, because I think as fans, we hear the idea of Demetrius Johnson fighting TJ Dillashaw and we think, oh, awesome fight, let's do it, hashtag would watch. And then think about how often this happens. The next thing we hear is Dana White coming out and saying, well, fighter X won't fight fighter Y, and it's bullshit, and I'm mad. And like, for much of the history of this company, a lot of people would be like, yeah, Dana, I'm mad too. But then you read Demetrius Johnson's account, and as you're right, he lays it out well over 2,000 plus words, and you realize, wait a second, like there's a lot more going on here. Demetrius Johnson is actually a rational person, has a lot of good points to make, and has a plan for himself, which is fight Ray Borg and then fight Cody Garbrandt, which, you know, if the whole thing comes to fruition, is arguably kind of better than what the UFC wants him to do. So, yeah, man, it's just another example that, you know, the official story that you get in the media first is not always the true or correct one. And in addition to that, I would just say, and I think this is positive, that it's starting to feel like as we gain more information and the sport continues to change, the industry continues to change, and we learn more about how this stuff happens, I feel like industry-wide, people are less apt to merely take the company line as fact these days. And I think that that is a positive development.
Well, I mean, that's a positive development. The risk is that I think more and more, if you ask a bunch of like hardcore MMA fans, what's the worst thing about being an MMA fan, they'll say every once in a while when you get an idea of how management is doing the fighters, and it gets just harder to stomach supporting it. I think that there's a real risk that you just alienate people because they decide, wait a minute, I'm giving my money to this company over and over again, and by and large, that money is not making it to the fighters, it's making it to the people who are frustrating the hell out of me and making me depressed about this sport.
Well, that's a downer note to end on.
Sorry.
We'll see what happens to Demetrius Johnson, I guess. You want to do just saying stuff?
Sure.
And then we'll get out of here for this week. Well, Ben, this week, my just saying stuff goes out to Jimmy Manoa, light heavyweight title contender, who had this to say, I believe also on the MMA Hour today, with Ariel Helwani saying that he's been promised if he can go out there and beat the Big O, Volkan Ozdemir.
Nailed it.
He's going to get the next title shot. His quote, I can't argue with John Jones getting the shot, but I believe I'll knock Volkan out, and then I'll get a title shot after that. To which I am just saying, book it. Done deal.
Yep.
Jimmy Manoa, nothing to worry about. Put your feet up. You got this one in the bank. Start spending the money today. Because we all know, once you get promised a UFC title shot, it's as good as gold,
yep,
my friend.
Take it to the bank.
Just saying.
Just saying. Well, Chad, I'm just saying, you know, we just got finished talking about enmity between the UFC and one of its champions, which I know you're sitting there and you're thinking, wow, what are the chances of that happening?
Right.
That never happens.
Sure.
I'm just saying, remember back when the UFC yanked Conor McGregor off of UFC 200 because of a disagreement over media appearances? Remember when George St. Pierre, after holding it down for eons as Mr. Pay-Per-View for the UFC, said that he wanted to take a little time off, and Dana White showed up at the post-fight press conference and screamed until his head turned purple? Remember when Anderson Silva had a stretch of ho-hum fights, culminating with that one against Demian Maia, and Dana White said that if he saw another one like that, he would cut Anderson Silva, one of the greatest mixed martial artists of all time. Remember when he got into such a bitter feud with Tito Ortiz, they were actually going to box each other on TV?
Produce a documentary about it.
Remember when Randy Couture, then the UFC heavyweight champion, resigned over a disagreement about money when the UFC just suddenly stopped giving him the bonuses they'd been giving him after every single fight, and then that became a protracted legal battle? I'm just saying, Chad, maybe what we're seeing here is not an isolated incident. Maybe this is a part of a very well-established and long-running pattern. Just saying.
Just saying. Wow. I love you on trend pieces.
Just saying.
Terrific. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event Podcast. We will be back next week to talk about the stuff that happens at the Derek Lewis, Mark Hunt fight, and then look ahead to the next weekend, which I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is Holly Holm versus Betch Kohea on thefightpass.com, perhaps?
Betch, please.
As for right now, though, we are done. We are through. We are out.
Get it? Because her name sounds... Yes.
No, I got you.
Okay.
I was reading your mail on that one.
I was really waiting a long time for that one.
Yeah,
and
no,
it felt like you kind of no-sold it.
Probably had a sticky on your computer. That should be waiting back months.
Don't worry, it's not going to be the last time I use it.
No, I...